Blog Talk Radio.
Found Masonic Companion. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. We have an interesting show today. This 8th of June 2014, the 159th day of the year. Imagine there's only 209 days left. When you look up at the evening sky tonight, you'll see a light to the left of the moon. And that's Mars, just after dark, of course. Then to the right of it is Spica, the star. And if you're after dark, you'll look up and see the Big Dipper, and the handle is hanging down. The Native Americans, the first North Americans, Native people, tell the legend that the Big Dipper moves and from the spring when it holds all of the energy and light until the fall, when you see the handle over the course of the summer, the handle starts to rise up until it begins to tip, and the dipper tips out the colors of the fall. You'll see that in September, October. So once upon a time. Remember the little, you see the handle? That middle star is called Mizar. Mizar, M-I-Z-A-R. Right now we're enjoying 16 hours and 25 minutes of sunlight. Ah, solstice is coming up. We're very, very close to the maximum amount of light. That's 16 hours and 33 minutes. So this morning the sun was up at 5:31. I was up with my old dog at 5:00. But it doesn't set until 9:57. It's remarkable. When things max out, we only get 16 hours and 33 minutes of sunlight. So we're pretty close. I'm going to talk to you, Dave. I'm going to share with you a bit of music. Thanks for the response. You can see that I'm trying to create more appeal and maintain the integrity of the program to recognize all of the faithful who have been following and supporting Masonic Companion since we started back in December of 2010. Yeah, it's been that long. The more I've been reading about Masonry, the more I've become, had this feeling that we have evolved and responded to things going on around us. The larger social and cultural environment, just like, we don't live in and operate in isolation, never have. And it's taken us away from the way we describe the Masonic order. Now, let me explain that before you get too harsh with me. I think that we can agree that Freemasonry, the ideas of equality and harmony, are aspects that came to the surface historically with through defining events, periods of time in our past. The 16th century, the Reformation occurred. Now, in a nutshell, that was a desire to change the role and power and influence of the Catholic Church. And it wasn't so much, I think, it wasn't isn't so much speaking about the nature of the faith, the theology, but the politics of the faith being front and center in people's lives in a way that became a repository for complications, and it became an unnecessary event in people's lives, which I think prompted this desire for the Reformation. I don't think it was as simple as some king wanting to declare himself with some divine right. I don't think it was that simple. But that was 16th century. We have those values. But we also claim a sense of the Renaissance. That's a period that in Europe between the 14th and 17th century. There are parts of it in the 12th century too. But my point is that it's of a time long ago. Great ideas were coming to the surface. Theories were being proposed to account for origins and characteristics, and but we claim the philosophies. We indulge ourselves in understanding the philosophical notions of the Greeks, and when they were conquered by the Romans, we saw how Rome realize the richness of the Greek culture and adapt, what would you say, use your own language, adapted it, renamed the and upgraded, in the Roman sense, upgraded their gods even, and a recognition of cultural enrichment, not cultural, the need, an appetite to dominate culturally. So if we exist with ideas that came from that time out of memory, as Tom Simmernick asked me one time about 4 years ago, did I think that we had the roots of Freemasonry went back to the Egyptian period? And it made me think. Tom's a thoughtful man. Not in the sense that there's a direct lineage, no more than there is between between Masonry and Templars. Direct, that's just, but the storyline is nevertheless valid. We refer constantly and proudly about the notions of Solomon. We're really talking about this metaphor that's come to us as the demonstration of wisdom and patience. We can trace that back. We can look at the provenance, the origins. That's a term used in the art communities. Where has that painting been? The hands that it went through. Well, there's a provenance to Freemasonry as well. My point being that Freemasonry, if you say that all of those ideas combined, blended, boiled down, the alchemist's dream, have produced this motherlode, have produced gold from base metals, have produced richness from simple matter. Of course, then we are all alchemists, aren't we? Oh, were we thinking they were just mad scientists mixing things together and they were deluded? Well, no. There was that time when science and philosophy wasn't separate. When science and belief wasn't separate. It was one. And we struggled very much to regain that high ground. But then this tells us that Freemasonry existed as in idea and in thought and in practice, and it had a history before the walls of a Grand Lodge were created. That is, that it exists even today beyond Constitution. How we practice it, it's a different matter. Where we practice it, different matter. You know very much that I think Grand Lodge offers us an essential protection. But to think that the essence of what we are is a building or a constitution or a governance structure or management really has changed, I think, the meaning in a very unsatisfactory way. All of this should tell us that the very essence, the antiquity of Freemasonry is achievable. It's in the mind of the individual to determine his own sense of reality of it. Yes, the walls are there and we say this is Grand Lodge, but we use that term figuratively. Is it Freemasonry? It's another issue. Some would say would not have any understanding of what prompts the question. And that's okay, you know. But if you're beginning to get to a point in your life where you're wondering about the answers, the important things, you need a little bit of guidance and support. You want to visit the oracle, but you can't get to Delphi. Well, Freemasonry is full of the wisdom of the oracle, but it's not self-evident. You have to do a little work to figure out the meaning. Yeah, we all do. So as we move forward with Masonic Companion, I wanted to do that with the spirit of regaining, reclaiming our historic birthright. Nobody has taken it from us. It's all around us. Nobody has made a mistake or been been misguided. We're not children. This isn't about the exercise of authority. Too often we can be confused that Freemasonry is about rank and order. Well, it isn't. Freemasonry exists in the heart and minds of people like you. That's where it exists. That's why it's hard to kill it or disgrace it or shame it out of existence. But we seem to be making Freemasonry very, very unusually difficult. Doesn't it puzzle you? Why do we seem to make it so hard? Funny that. Well, today we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And we're going to blend in a bit of music, Masonic period music, some just that beautiful self-indulgence of mine. And you know, we have a composer that I think it just amazes us. Gershwin's back here today with the Rhapsody in Blue. Just incredible. We're a funny little creature, human beings. We are quite opinionated. We have our own opinions, and every one of them is right, except all of those that aren't right. And we're never really sure. So in the meantime, we do the best we can. Have a little, you know, sometimes there's stunning comments that just bring it all together. It's an old German proverb that says wisdom is better than gold or silver. And I think we can live with that. There's an old Latin proverb that says it is best to learn wisdom by the experience of others. What do you think? And Solomon ibn Gabriel said, and I just think this is beautiful. These are the five steps of wisdom. Get out your gavel and chisel and put these in the concrete. Put these in the stone. Put these in the marble. The first step is the acquisition. In the acquisition of wisdom is silence. Aude vide tace, our motto. The second, listening. So shh. And pay attention. That's what he's saying. The third is memory. You've heard that feeble debate that we should not require our poor impose memory work on any of our members. Well, this is where that idea comes from. The fourth step in the acquisition of wisdom is practice. And the fifth is teaching others. William James said this, "The art of being wise is knowing what to overlook." So overlook the shortcomings of people around us, because they're our brothers and we need them. Remember, it's hard to take back a criticism. It's easier to forgive an enemy than it is a friend. Isn't that hurt? It's because we put our guard down and we trust them not to hurt us. When they say the wrong thing, it really does penetrate. Plutarch, ancient Greek. Nature and wisdom never are at strife. He's explaining how we fit, where our minds fit. But let me move on from this with Pythagoras. After his death, you know, the Pythagorean colleges were knocked down. He got under the skin of a lot of people. The wise man should be prepared for everything that does not lie within his control. So think about that. Can you really control it? Well, just get all pouty and stamp your foot and have a temper tantrum. I think Pythagoras is helping our minds to mature. Maybe it's not your beck and call to try and be wise as you go through life. But you recognize what you can control, what you can influence, and what is beyond your control. Making other people do things is fraught with problems. A wise man learns by the mistakes of others, a fool by his own. It's a Latin proverb. And I've heard an old carpenter tell me this once. Measure twice, cut once. This comes from a Turkish proverb. Measure 1,000 times and cut once. Seneca said, there's an interesting read, the work of Seneca. No man was ever wise by chance. And a writer that we've had on the program, his work on the program at different times, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he has not learned the lesson of life who does not every day surmount a fear. I don't mean to belabor the point, but, you know, we're going to start with a little, go back in history. This is the music that our ancient brethren, not so ancient brethren, our grandfathers, my grandfather, maybe your, if you're younger, if you're in your 30s and 40s, it'd be your great-grandfather would have listened to if he had access to this kind of music. You know, here in Canada, theater was where the imagination was stretched. We didn't have television. There was time for radio was the entertainment, and it wasn't on constantly. We've created a real interesting sensation for ourselves. And of course, there's going to be consequences. This was a time, even if we hear about the Greek plays, the famous Greek plays, Euripides and Sophocles were writers. But the plays were not put on 4 nights a week on with a matinee on Saturday or 5 nights a week. No. Often they were put on once. And the audiences were fights because the theaters weren't able to hold everybody because these plays might never be repeated. We know them because we have the manuscripts. But think about it. There wasn't any other place to have your ideas and your values tested in open form, I guess. We could say that. So the Greeks would hold these theaters and they would be advertised. And just to get in, people would become violent just to be there. And they would go on for a great long time, hours and hours and hours. So don't make the mistake of thinking that everything was nice and polite and lined up and we had a little numbered seat and cushion and a program handed to us. That's a very recent day event. But these are periods gone by. This is music from the 30s and 40s. We're just going to hear a little piece and see what you think. Sorry. I'm pulling that in off YouTube, of course. Harry Hayes, music of the 30s. This is the music that the men and women that clung to after the First World War. It's upbeat. It's alive. It's hopeful. It's forward-thinking. All the kind of atmosphere that you want to create and you've just been through something horrible. Let's not forget, I don't want to be too maudlin, but we've just passed the commemoratives for D-Day, a period in Canadian history when a lot of men died at Juno Beach, a battle that defined our nation, and reminds us that we are a young nation, but we are also a very brave, courageous bunch of people. Gotta love it. I'm never ashamed to say it. The episode, we move on to the episode. This is about belief and magic. Why non-believers never ever see it. Why non-believers? Amazing, isn't it? Never ever see it. Governance and management, necessary if kept in proportion, numbing if not. Control. It seduces us with the scent of predictability and power. We trade on reality, convincing ourselves Freemasons have an ability to foresee the future. The way we look at history is less kind. Think about the way we drop names of great men who happen to have been Freemasons. Gives us a certain panache, a certain currency, doesn't it? Habit lulls us into distilling, crunching, and compressing centuries of influence and events, enough that we should all cringe. All these great, great minds didn't know each other. They weren't hanging around together. If you went visiting, you didn't bump into all these great minds. They existed through history. And we have the stew that's been boiled down, Masonically boiled, to make it seem that all the rest, the hundreds and thousands of millions of brethren, were invisible. Don't think for a moment that distillation obscures the truth. Understanding has become opaque as a result. It's difficult to... Conformity is such a tasty ale, isn't it? Just go along with it. Local tradition is often laughed about. That's just fellows making it up as they go along. Too many pearls, huh? Too much science mixed to fit known facts. You just change the mixture. Change or deepen our understanding of Masonic history, and the outcomes will obviously change. What separates us from our impressions of what we were? What is that? Is it building a room for serious conversation without risk of ridicule? Is it titillating to talk about the past? History can minimize complications, a long time ago. I don't have to think about the different lifestyle of somebody throwing his leg into a sup with camel and going up to do battle in the great circuses, the First World War. I don't think about that. What I think about is the bravery and the gentlemanly respect. Almost seems odd, doesn't it, that these fighters would have such respect when we began to be faced with the reality of Vietnam on our evening news every day. As much as it can minimize complication, robust comrades facing tough, we think about it, facing tough entrance requirements, aristocracy rubbing shoulders with commoners, those merchants to begin. Oh, imagine that. It was the time before uniformity that gives us the greatest sense of mystery. We didn't have machinery cranking out regalia. So we all look the same and dress the same. No, sort of a come as you are. Whatever you've got in your back, perfectly all right. As long as you dress like a gentleman. Make an effort. Make an effort. It's a special event. What records extent leave gaps for us to speculate, creating treasures for the mind pregnant with promise that membership provides a way to nurture character development. It is disingenuous to offer something unless we can deliver. Unfortunately, this hasn't stopped us. We continually offer this. We do a bait and switch. Come into our Masonic rooms where you will find men, learned men, men of wisdom, living in harmony with one another, in discussion of philosophical principle, operationalizing those ideas to fit individual lives, and in doing that, producing the change, bringing out the change, the best of your character. That's the promise. The reality, far from it. Imagine the disappointment of somebody that comes in having read a great deal about the craft, the history of the craft, creating that anticipation, knocking on the door, going through the degrees, and then being faced with the coldness of reality. Somebody has their hand out, hand in your pocket, reaching for your wallet, soliciting at every single meeting, every single keynote, as if you're not ever doing enough. You should be participating more. We have these other projects and we need your money. Not just once, but over and over and over, and multiple times. Pig roast, barbecues, lotteries, draws, upgrades to the roof, new regalia. Pick one. And then a list of noble, very noble, charitable events and research. Pick one. How did we ever get into this? We existed before telemarketing and before, you know, television became a platform for more marketplace advertising. We don't advertise the work of Pythagoras or the discussion around Plato's Republic or Albert Pike, his life. In the northeastern portion of the United States. Wasn't he born in Boston? Yeah. And then traveled to the West, walked to the West. We don't talk about that. Get through ritual rather quickly. And it's really interesting, a bit confusing, that we don't seem to even want to think about analyzing what's been going on. It's one would think when we are offering this, pulling people in, when they come of their own free will, Encore, asking for this, expecting it, one would think that we would be delivering this. It's not that we're... No, this isn't about chastisement. We're not children. This is more about observation. I like to think that one of the ways for us to grasp this is by studying something else parallel. And lately I've become more inclined to think that maybe the work of a poet or a writer. William Shakespeare comes to mind. His work was offered to us as schoolboys, and often we were left frightened of it. overwhelmed by it, confused, unable to follow it. Well, the language is different. But it was never written to be presented only in Victorian time, Victorian costume. Remember, he was the 16th century. He died on the 23rd of April, 1616. He was writing for the contemporary environment. At least when you see actors doing Shakespeare dressed like you and I, it's obvious that the director is trying to help us relate to the material. And he strings together ideas. It's not like he's saying something like we see on our sitcom, two or three lines and a laugh track, two or three lines and a laugh track. The work is delivered in iambic pentameter, a certain pace, da-dum, 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 da-dum. And when you look for it, you listen for that, you hear it, the emphasis. Not on the first, but on the second. Da-dum. The analysis. What is he trying to say? And we know that it gives us a deeper sense of the capacity of the English language to express emotion and thought. That has brought this poet's work around the world. Unquestionably. And I think it's a vehicle that Freemasons can use, that we can be schooled in how Shakespeare has been studied. The language has fallen out of use, so we have to make it contemporary. Just as it was with, and has been, with Masonic ritual. If we were looking at material written in Victorian time, the meaning of the words is different. Meaning completely different than it is today. And it's only because it's obscure. And what the words that we use are today have evolved and will be changed in the future. Listen to what I mean. A fool thinks himself to be wise, but a wise man knows himself to be a fool. And from the Merchant of Venice, this is about the Jew. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge. To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night, the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. To thy own self be true. See? If we approach that same mindset with the ritual that's around us, we might and probably would begin to truly understand and find things in it. We've passed a lot. We're still able to laugh at ourselves, I hope. Create some balance. Think of ourselves. Any of you listeners out there old enough to remember the Goon Show? Oh, yeah. It was a radio comedy back right after the Second World War. It was after I was born that it started, about 51. And it started like a lot of things. It started in Britain. Not like Monty Python started in Britain, but it was about, Monty Python, by the way, was about to be canceled after its first couple of shows, but first season. But It was a short season, but the reaction from the colonies, especially Canada, the people had an audience, and they were very upset with the BBC. The Monty Python might not be going on. And it was the same with Doctor Who. You know, it was the BBC reacting to listeners. And we have that incredibly. What is that, the longest running program in British BBC history? Yeah. Here's a little piece of the Goon Show. This is tongue-in-cheek, a little bit of humor, different than today.
Top two of the cups.
You see that piece of string on the table?
Yes, what's that space in the middle?
That's the piece that's missing.
So, now that's what a piece of missing string looks like, eh? Where's it gone? But wait, can't you see, you poor Scottish fool? It's all a practical joke. Someone's cut that string in the center, pulled the two pieces in opposite directions, giving the impression that a piece had been removed from the middle.
Harry Gringles, he's right. Oh, fish too. If you put these two pieces together, the gap disappears.
Aye, but did you notice when you did that, the two outside ends got shorter?
God. God, chiseled right. Now I see what happened. What cunning! The criminal cut a piece off each end, then cut across the middle and pulled them apart, making the string look the original length.
Oh, dear, this makes it a baffling case.
Aye, yes. Instead of one piece, we're looking for two separate ends. It's a good job, I can tell. We must start investigations at once.
Finally, here is a police message. Will all people in possession of two pieces of string please report to their local police station? Now,
Dear. Min. No, Min. Min.
You're calling me, Henry?
Yes. Hurry up, I'm next. Oh, you sinful woman, you. Always at the cigarette rolling machine, you.
Got the match, Henry.
You vixen. Not satisfied with making your own fags. Now you want to smoke them.
There's nothing to worry about, Henry. This is herbal tobacco.
Herbal?
Yes. Crazy herbal tobacco made from dandelions.
Well, don't leave any in my bedroom. Our water rates are high enough as it is.
Ah. Oh, these cigarettes are strong, Henry.
The Goon Show. Simpler times, eh? I wonder what they had on their minds. We can think about Freemasonry in so many different ways. And we'll put on a little bit of music, and then when I come back, I want to. This is a song by a writer and performer, James Taylor, somebody that. The kind of music that I was listening to many, many, many years ago. This is one of his songs called The Secret of Life. I think you'll find the lyrics a bit interesting.
Any fool can do it. We might as well enjoy the ride. Secret love is an opening of your heart. It's okay to feel afraid, but don't let it stand in your way no longer. Everyone knows that love is the only. We might as well show some style. Give us a smile, isn't that a lovely ride? Sliding down, try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride. Time is that time isn't really real. It's all on your point of view. How does it feel to you in there? Einstein said that he could never understand it all. A smile upon your face. Welcome to the human race. Some kind of lovely ride. See me sliding down and gliding down and trying not to try too hard. Just a lovely ride. Life is enjoying the passage of time.
Get it? Yeah, I thought it had a bearing. Nice little tune. Let's enjoy the ride, as James Taylor suggests. We're still in plunging into history in a very serious-minded way, talking about the king of drinks, wine. Alcuin was a scholar by the time of Charlemagne. He's one of Charlemagne's advisors, as a matter of fact. And he writes to a friend, he was visiting England in the early 9th century, believe it. Wine has gone from our wine skins and bitter beer rages in our bellies. And because we have it not, drink in our name and lead a joyful day. Ugh, poor man. He's saying that wine was scarce in England as it was elsewhere in Northern Europe. In those parts where wine could not be produced locally but had to be imported, beer and mead, that was a hybrid drink. It was made with cereal grains and fermented with honey. You could get those instead. The distinction between beer in Northern Europe and wine in the South persists to this day. Modern European drinking patterns crystallized during the middle of the first millennium and were largely determined by the reach of Greek and Roman influences. Still, those strong cultures have a bearing on us, and even today. Wine drinking, usually in moderation and with meals, still predominates in the south of Europe, within the former boundaries of the Roman Empire. In the north of Europe, beyond the reach of Roman rule, beer drinking, typically without the accompaniment of food, is more common. Today, the world's leading producers of wine are France, Italy, and Spain. And the people of Luxembourg, France, and Italy are the leading consumers of wine. drinking an average of around 55 liters per person per year. The countries where the most beer is consumed, in contrast, are mostly those regarded as barbarian territory by the Romans. Oh, Germany, Austria, Belgium, Denmark, the Czech Republic, Britain, and Ireland. Greek and Roman attitudes toward wine themselves, founded on earlier Near Eastern traditions, have survived in other ways. Spread around wherever alcohol is drunk, wine is regarded as the most civilized and cultured of drinks. In those countries, wine, not beer, is served at state banquets and political summits. An illustration of wine's enduring association with power, status, and wealth. Wine also provides the greatest scope for connoisseurship and social differentiation. Appreciation of wines from different places began with the Greeks. But we move on. A gift from the Arabs. Remember, once in the history, science was at the forefront. Mathematics, astronomy, astrology. What has happened? How the Arab greatness has faded. At the close of the first millennium, the greatest and most cultured city in Western Europe was not Rome or Byzantium or London. It was Cordoba, the capital of our Arab Andalusia. What is now southern Spain. Just had the king abdicate in Spain, didn't he? Classy little place. There were parks and palaces and paved roads and oil lamps to light the streets, 700 mosques, 300 public baths, drainage and sewage systems. Perhaps most of all was the public library, and that was finished in 970 AD and containing nearly 500,000 books, more books than any other European library and indeed most European countries. It was merely the largest of 70 libraries in the city. Can you imagine Cordoba? A 10th century German chronicler called Hroswitha described Cordoba as the jewel of the world. Cordoba was only one of the great centers of learning within the Arab world, a vast dominion that stretched at its height from the Pyrenees in France to the Pamir Mountains in Central Asia, and as far south as the Indus Valley in India. At a time when the wisdom of the Greeks had been lost in most of Europe, Arab scholars in Cordoba, Damascus, and Baghdad were building on knowledge from Greek, Indian, and Persian sources to make further advances in such fields as astronomy, mathematics, medicine, and philosophy. They developed the astrolabe, algebra, the modern numeral system, pioneered the use of herbs as anesthetics, and devised new navigational techniques based on the magnetic compass, which was introduced from China, trigonometry, and nautical maps. Among their most many achievements, they also refined and popularized a technique that gave rise to a new range of drinks. Distillation. That just involves vaporizing and then condensing a liquid in order to separate and purify it. Simple distillation equipment dating back to the 4th millennium BC has been found in northern Mesopotamia, where, judging from later cuneiform inscriptions, it was used to make perfumes. The Greeks and Romans were also familiar with the technique. Aristotle, for example, noted the vapor condensed from boiling salt water was not salty. But it was only later, starting in the Arab world, that distillation was routinely applied to wine, notably by the 8th century Arab scholar Jabir ibn Hayyan, who is remembered as one of the fathers of chemistry. He devised an improved form of distillation apparatus, or still, with which he and other Arab alchemists distilled wine and other substances for use in their experiments. Distilling wine makes it much stronger because the boiling point of alcohol, 78 degrees centigrade, is lower than that of water, 100 degrees centigrade. I guess that was evident to any school child in Canada. As the wine is slowly heated, vapor begins to rise from its surface long before the liquid starts to boil. Due to alcohol's lower boiling point, this vapor contains proportionally more alcohol and less water than the original liquid. Drawing off and condensing this alcohol-rich vapor produces a liquid with a far higher alcohol content than wine, though it is far from being pure alcohol, since some water and other impurities evaporate with it. The alcohol content can be increased by repeated distillation. That term is known as rectification. I didn't know that. Knowledge of distillation is one of the many aspects of the ancient wisdom that was preserved and extended by Arab scholars, and having been translated from Arabic into Latin, helps to rekindle the spirit of learning in Western Europe. The word alembic, which refers to a type of still, encapsulates this combination of ancient knowledge and Arab innovation. And it is all of that is derived from the Greek word embix, which refers to the specifically shaped vase used in distillation. Who knew? So the term was used more generally by alchemists to refer to other highly purified substances, including liquids, so that distilled wine later came to be known in English as alcohol of wine. From their obscure origins in alchemical laboratories, the new drinks made possible by distillation became dominant during the Age of Exploration, as seafaring European explorers established colonies and then empires around the world. Distilled drinks provided a durable and compact form of alcohol for transport on board ship and found a range of other uses. These drinks became economic goods of such significance that their taxation and control became matters of great political importance and helped to determine the course of history. The abstemious Arab scholars who first distilled wine regarded the result as alchemical ingredients or a medicine rather than an everyday drink. Only when knowledge of distillation spread into Christian Europe did distilled spirits become more widely consumed. So, a little bit more. It was used medicinally back in the 14th century. So next time we're together, we'll add a little bit to that. Just a beautiful little song. You'll hear a beautiful little song. We'll come up to that. Before we get to that, I want to talk to you, add a little more about the 44. Remember, we're getting through the 44 landmarks, definitions of landmarks. Remember? By Johnson, in his self-teaching manual called Masonry Defined. This is number 19. We stopped at number 18 last week. A belief in the existence of God as the grand architect of the universe is one of the most important landmarks of the order. It has always been admitted that denial of the existence of a supreme and superintending power is an absolute disqualification for initiation. The annals of the order never yet have furnished or could furnish an instance in which an avowed atheist was ever made a Mason. The very initiatory ceremonies of the first degree prevent the possibility of such an occurrence. The 20th, subsidiary to this belief in God as the landmark of the order, is the belief in a resurrection to a future life. This landmark is not so positively impressed on the candidate by exact words as the preceding, but the doctrine is taught by very plain implication and runs through the whole symbolism of the order. To believe in Masonry and not to believe in resurrection would be an absurd anomaly, which could only be excused by the reflection that he who thus confounded his belief in skepticism was so ignorant of the meaning of both theories as to have no rational foundation for his knowledge of either. 21st, It is a landmark that the book of the law shall constitute an indispensable part of the furniture of every lodge. I say advisedly book of the law because it is not absolutely required that everywhere the book, the Old and New Testament shall be used. The book of law is that volume which by the religion of the country is believed to contain the revealed will of the grand architect of the universe. Hence in all lodges in Christian countries, the book of law is composed of the Old and New Testaments. In a country where Judaism was the prevailing faith, the Old Testament would be sufficient. And in Mohammedan countries and among Mohammedan Masons, the Quran might be considered, Freemasonry does not attempt to interfere with the peculiar religious faiths of its disciples, except so far as relates to the belief in the existence of God, and what necessarily results from that belief. The Book of Law is to the speculative Mason his spiritual trestle board. Without this, he cannot labor. The landmark, therefore, requires that a Book of the Law, a religious code of some kind, purporting to be an exemplar of the revealed will of God, shall form an essential part of the furniture of every lodge. Number 23, the equality of all Masons is another landmark of the order. This equality has no reference to any subversion or those gradations of rank which have been instituted by the usages of society. See, so we're defining what equality means. It's not like we're equal to the Grand Master. See? It has no reference to that, to subvert those gradations. The monarch, the nobleman, or the gentleman is entitled to all the influence and receives all the respect which rightfully belongs to his position. But the doctrine of Masonic equality implies that as children of one great father, we meet in the lodge upon the level, that on that level we are all traveling to one predestined goal, that in the lodge genuine merit shall receive more respect than boundless wealth, and that virtue and knowledge alone should be the basis of all Masonic honors and be rewarded with preferment. We've lost our grasp of the value of merit, sad to say. That doesn't exist in most lodges anymore. The populist notions fueled by political gain and ego is more prevalent these days. And the last I'll get into today is the secrecy of the institution. It's another and most important landmark. This is one that's been kicked around quite a bit. And I think it was just very self-serving. Not too long ago, we had high-ranking officials making exposés to the media. Tisk, tisk. The secrecy of the institution is another and most important landmark. The form of secrecy is a form inherent in it, existing with its from its very foundation and secured to it by its ancient landmarks. If divested of this secret character, it would lose its identity. It would cease to be Freemasonry. Whatever objections may therefore be made to the institution on account of its secrecy, and however much some unskilled brethren have been unwilling at times of trial for the sake of expediency to divest it of its secret character, it will be ever impossible to do so, even were the landmark not standing before us as an insurmountable obstacle, because such change of its character would be social suicide, and the death of the order would follow its legalized exposure. Freemasonry as a secret association has lived unchanged for centuries. As an open society, it would not last for as many years. Makes you think, doesn't it? If you're sitting there expecting that you should be nodding at all of these, then this has been a lost effort. It's just to make you think. To make you think about how a fellow is you know, a thoughtful Mason, one that wants to share the knowledge, is trying to help us to understand the landmarks. What are they? What in the world do they mean? Most Masons, this is from the work by Christopher Hoda, why we seem to find that this fellow is full of revelations is a little bit of a puzzle to me. It's rather straightforward, except he put it together in an interesting little book, shamefully called Freemasons for Dummies. Most people who join a lodge, he says, are not aware that there are competing organizations in the world that call themselves Masonic, but are not considered to be legitimate by the majority of Freemasons. Only regular, recognized Masons can make regular, recognized Masons. Only regular, recognized Grand Lodges can charter regular, recognized lodges, or agree to cede a territory to a new Grand Lodge. Over the centuries, disgruntled Masons have started new groups. Some Grand Lodges have changed their rules, and those changes violate the rules of the mainstream. Some enterprising hucksters have created new Masonic debris or groups simply for the purpose of making money by trading on the reputation of Freemasonry. Still others have discovered or created new rituals that they purport to be better, more interesting, more enlightening, or more correct. For whatever reason, there are several thousand members of groups who are not regarded as legitimate Freemasons by the worldwide majority. Thus the need there, brethren, for rules and the high walls of our lodges. That's the most useful work that our Grand Lodge can provide us, to give us the protection we need, because we're frail. We can go about our business making discussion without charlatans and hawks having their way. None of this is a huge issue for the individual Mason until he starts to travel and visit other lodges or encounters other Masons. And a regular Mason will not be welcomed into a mainstream lodge, and his degrees and documents will not be considered legitimate. He will not be entitled to the honors, benefits, and fraternalism enjoyed by millions in the Masonic world. This is not to say that unrecognized Masonic groups have nothing to offer. It's simply a warning so that you're certain that the lodge you join will provide what you're looking for. Interesting. I think he is of it. Since 1980, 58% fewer people attend some kind of club meeting. 45% fewer people say they invite friends over to their homes, and an incredible 33% fewer people say they have family dinners together. It's higher than that now. Robert Putnam calls these connections social capital, and he argues that social capital is every bit as important as the monetary kind. It is important to the community and to the individual to interconnect, communicate, and participate with each other. Study after study shows that communities that fail to interconnect have higher crime rates, worse drug problems, poorer health, and more suicides. Business types are fond of the term networking as if friendships only exist for business purposes, and whether they come right out and say it or not, networking comes down to believing that someone you actually know might actually do you a favor. Or as Yogi Berra once said, if you don't go to someone's funeral, they won't come to yours. Networks you may not think about, like sports clubs, neighborhood associations, political action groups, or just friendship with another couple, are all essential types of social capital. And the fewer of these connections, the less likely it is that members of a community will cooperate and work for their mutual well-being. Friends and family cheer you up, bring you chicken soup when you're sick, and help you find jobs when you're laid off. Babysit the kids and maybe loan you $20 when you're broke or buy you a drink at the bar. And if you do it for them in return, life without these connections is pretty bleak. And believe it or not, having fewer of these connections actually reduces your life expectancy. Not a competition. It's not a competition. It's just the way it is. Things that we are describing, we don't know why. I'm going to let you finish the program today. We're listening to Brother Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. It's worth, I think it's worth, if you have to go, I understand. But if you're more reflective today, I think it's worth tuning in, just listening to it. Catherine the Great said, the more a man knows, the more he forgives. Charles Dickens tells us that a loving heart is the truest wisdom. So you decide, eh? How prone to doubt, how cautious are the wise? Well, that's Homer, not Simpson. I'll leave you with a notion from Confucius. Confucian society was complicated. The man of wisdom, he says, is never of two minds. The man of benevolence never worries. The man of courage is never afraid. Wisdom is the sunlight of the soul, German proverb. I hope you enjoy Gershwin. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to being with you again in a week's time. In the meantime, be out there committing that act of random Masonic kindness that only a Mason could come up with. Think about whether the solicitation in lodges has gone on and infiltrated everything to our detriment. Yeah, there's a time and a place for everything, and I'm thinking it might be time just to pull it all back. Maybe we can't afford to do everything without, or maybe we're not prepared to pay the price of such high level of the solicitation. The world around us has changed after all. And something is causing good fellows to walk away from us. I tend to think it's the disingenuous notion. We're doing a bait and switch. We promise insight. We don't carry it out. We don't act it. We bring, in fact, the limits of our own experience into lodge. And that is not Masonic. But of all parts of wisdom, the practice is the best. So I'm going to be quiet now. See ya.
and don't make me cry. Say nothing, but don't say goodbye. I didn't mean to treat you bad. Didn't know just what I had. But honey, now I'm.
Just makes you feel good, doesn't it, brethren? Thanks for joining me. Look forward to having you back soon. Couldn't do it without you.